This is Margaret Wilkinson, Undoing Dissociation, May 18th, 2007.
Seattle, what a fantastic city. You know, the inevitable jibe that I get when I ring home is, oh, are you sleepless? and I say, no, never have I slept so well, because I've been seeing this wonderful city and fabulous museums, and I was born by the sea, grew up by the sea, so a city by the water, I think, is just wonderful. And when the wind got up this afternoon, I could smell the salt, and it was my childhood back, you know. Lovely, lovely. So what a beautiful city. We're very pleased, the Journal of Analytical Psychology, to have Michael Horn as the American editor. I think we're looking forward to a very fruitful period of time. For the journal. So Seattle has become an important city for us in that way as well. And Michael very kindly made the contacts for me, which made it possible for me to come here. So thank you to Michael again. Now, straight to the subject. In recent years, huge interest has developed in contemporary neuroscience and attachment theory, and their relevance to clinical practice. The undoing of dissociation is an area where such insights are of particular importance to us in our clinical work. In the 1990s, which have been called the decade of the brain, new research tools have enabled much more detailed knowledge of brain processes. Gone forever are the unquestioning days of the dualism of Descartes, when mind and brain could be understood as two entirely separate entities, and the scholars of one would never have been expected to be acquainted with the scholarship of those who studied the other. Complete split. But now we must make new connections, and I think these connections are vital for our understanding of how to work particularly with those who've experienced early relational trauma, whose trauma happened to them in the time when their brain was at its most plastic, when their brain was really developing in its earliest stages. Inevitably, it must affect brain, it must affect mind. And now we can look in detail at how and in what ways. And so I'm talking now about patients whose defences are early and are dissociative. It takes us right back as Jungians to our roots in the French dissociationist tradition, something we're not always aware of. But Janet and later Charcot in Paris towards the end of the 19th century were the first to propose that traumatic memories can become split off, wiped out. Janet stressed that extreme emotional arousal might result in the effects of trauma lingering on in an unintegrated way because it had never been able to be processed adequately. And both Freud and Jung studied in Paris, embraced dissociationist theory, and wrote very convincingly in support of it. Jung commented, for instance, "As a result of some psychic upheaval, whole tracts of our being can plunge back into the unconscious and vanish from the surface for years and decades. Disturbances caused by affect," said Jung, "are known technically as phenomena of dissociation and are indicative of a psychic split." You could take the very beautiful book that's come out this year by the Dutch and American researchers Nijenhuis, Steele and van der Hart, which is called The Haunted Self, and you could insert those words of Jung into the text and everybody would think they were, you know, 21st century researchers writing those words. Jung was so prescient. We don't have to move away from Jungian traditions to embrace the most up-to-date neuroscience of our day. The two things sit very comfortably together. I don't think it's quite so easy for the Freudians to say that. So back to Jung. He warned all along that the real emotional significance of a childhood traumatic experience can remain hidden from the patient. And he said, so that as it never reaches consciousness, the emotion never wears itself out. It's never used up. Those researchers I was talking about talk about the emotional personality, the vehement emotion that's associated with it, the part that's split off from the everyday, adaptive, normal self. Again, you can transpose Jung. You wouldn't know which was the researcher and which was Jung. Jung continues, a traumatic complex brings about the dissociation of the psyche. The complex is not under the control of the will, and for this reason it possesses the quality of psychic autonomy. He said, these fragments, these psychic splinter psyches, become split off because of traumatic experience. He also warned how such experience can suddenly return to consciousness. He said, it forces itself tyrannically upon the conscious mind. The explosion of affect is a complete invasion of the individual. It pounces upon him like an enemy or a wild animal. That's so similar to the description of fragmentary return of memory that's caused by state-dependent reminders that trauma patients experience. The flashbacks, those sort of situations. That's what Jung was describing. But later, you know, both Freud and Jung were to move away from this interpsychic view of development, and they came rather to stress the intrapsychic world. Today, I think, we realize that it's not either or, it's both and. We understand, because of what we know from the brain scans of early development, that interpsychic produces intrapsychic. So not either or, but both and. The effects of adverse external experience lost ground for a while to fantasy, as analysts sought to understand better the roots of internal object relations within the psyche. But work with soldiers from World War I, studies here of Vietnam veterans, research with those who've been sexually abused in childhood, led again to renewed emphasis on this earlier perspective that I've just described to you, that real, overwhelmingly traumatic events can disappear from the mind and be held only in the unconscious, in what we call implicit memory, in the form of complexes. Now, alongside that understanding that comes from the experience of trauma, we have to hold the insights that come from attachment theory and Bowlby's groundbreaking work at the Tavistock Institute in London on attachment theory rejected excessive Kleinian emphasis on fantasy and offers a further reminder that real traumatic events happen to children and that these real events exert a strong developmental influence on the way children experience the world and relate to others. Could we have the next overhead? Thanks. In this country, the work of Alan Shaw and Daniel Siegel has emphasized that in the case of the newborn brain, healthy development is stimulated by good experiences in the relationship with the primary caregiver, but that early brain development is adversely affected by traumatic experiences in this first relationship. You know, a mum really grows her baby's brain. If you think about good experience, mum and baby interacting, smiling, lolling, talking to one another, what's called proto-conversation, making sounds to one another, looking at each other, reaching out their hands to each other. As the mum has happy feelings, smiley feelings, joyous feelings, amused feelings, patterns fire in her brain. Neuronal pathways are being stimulated to have those feelings. But what's so significant is in the passive, plastic baby brain, exactly the same firing patterns fire. So the mother, through her affection and love, grows the patterns in her baby's brain. She grows those patterns for healthy emotion experience. But the other side of the story is that the mother, who for whatever reason is feeling very down, very angry, very frightened, very anxious, and she looks at her baby and mirrors those feelings to her baby, the mirror neurons in her baby's brain will fire in response to those patterns. Now, I'm making it rather too extreme, aren't I? Because mums, you know, every mum gets cross sometimes, and rarely is the baby unfortunate enough that mum's mood is never one of joy when she looks at the baby. So it isn't always those extremes, and it's going to be some mix somewhere in the middle most of the time, isn't it? But what we're saying is, in Sue Gerhardt's book, she called her book Why Love Matters, and the subheading title is How Affection Shapes a Baby's Brain. And that book is probably less than $20 on Amazon now, and is well worth buying. It's called Why Love Matters, How Affection Shapes a Baby's Brain by Sue Gerhardt, which is G-E-R-H-A-R-D, and about 2004 she probably wrote it, something like that. A baby, if it gets into a state of really frantic distress, if mum can't meet its needs for whatever reason, if that state of distress remains unresolved, you see the baby switch off and begin to stare into space with a very glazed look. That's what we call dissociation. That's the beginning of the dissociative response. Alan Shaw suggests that if the baby continually experiences states of unbearable fear, terror, or aggression coming from the mother's face, then dissociation will become the primary regulatory process that will be resorted to throughout the lifespan. When the person gets stressed, they'll go off. They'll get a vague look. If you're working with them in the consulting room, you'll feel as though they've switched off. If you're the teacher working with them in school, you'll think, why is that child suddenly switched off? You know? They've gone elsewhere because something has made it too difficult, too painful to stay exactly where they are currently. And that's what they've learnt very, very early on through very major distress it would take to do that. Alan Shaw concludes that attachment trauma induces an enduring impairment of the primordial central integrating structure of the nascent self. Chaffetz comments, dissociation aims to protect the self. The baby's little self is trying to manage, trying to get by. Yet in its attempts to triumph over the self, to switch off, it actually injures the self. And it leads to enduring, it leads to enduring changes in subjectivity. Early brain development is adversely affected by traumatic experiences. Teicher's work in the States again has shown that impaired connections occur between the right and left hemispheres, and that the fiber tract known as the corpus callosum, that's the major highway between the two hemispheres, may actually become reduced through the effects of trauma in those who've experienced childhood sexual abuse. So the link road between the right and the left hemisphere is impaired, where there's been over and over and over again experience of early relational trauma. Why might that be, you say? Perhaps. Mum, babies arrive with their right hemisphere pretty much well developed. It's ready for off. It's ready to work. It's up and running. And the right hemisphere deals with emotion, how we feel. It deals with visual stimulus, and it deals with faces, and it deals with frightening feelings. It's particularly well geared up to deal with frightening feelings, because evolutionarily, we needed to be pretty well geared up to deal with frightening feelings if we were going to survive. You know, we remember to run or fight rather than just, you know, allow ourselves to be eaten. So that's why it comes that way. It's an evolutionary thing. But if the mum and the baby are doing all right together, when the mum is busy lolling and the baby smiling, a stimulus goes across to the left hemisphere, which doesn't really develop fully until the child is about 2.5 or 3 years old. So how does it develop? It's growing after birth. How does that happen? Well, in those interactions between mum and baby, a stimulus goes to the left hemisphere, and in particular to the centers in the left hemisphere, which will later develop into language centers for listening to language and for developing language. So mum and baby enjoy one another, smile at one another, and the center for language grows a little. Repeats over and over again. And then ultimately the baby is able to socialize, communicate. So it's grown by that good relationship. In trauma, when the baby gets really, really frightened, or in any of us, when we get really, really frightened, the girl who walks back too late across the dark park and gets raped, when she's really, really frightened, afterwards she'll say to her therapist, "Why didn't I shout? Why didn't I say no? Why didn't I shout? Somebody might have heard." And the actual answer is, you couldn't. Because one of the things the brain does in those moments of awful trauma is it shuts down the corpus callosum. It breaks the link between right and left. And the reason it does it is to preserve for a better day and a better time, those higher left hemisphere functions, those functions of speech, understanding, mathematical ability, those higher things that we as human beings tend to perhaps overvalue a bit too much, you know. But our brain does as well. It protects that left hemisphere. And it actually comes as quite a relief to somebody who's been in that situation and who says, "Why didn't I process?" to actually know that they couldn't, you know, that their system had shut that capacity down for that period of time when they were in, you know, all systems go, this is acute trauma. You begin to see that I'm perhaps talking in a slightly different way about therapy, because have I just said, those of you who are therapists sitting here, has she just actually said she would teach her patient something in the therapy hour? Very rarely, yes, I would. If I have the teenager who comes after a very bad car accident where a car's, I'm thinking of one now, where the car mounted the pavement, crossed the grass verge and actually knocked this youngster down. And she kept saying again and again, "If only I could see his face, if only I could see his face." And she really needed help to understand how the brain tries to process trauma in order to understand what was going on inside her. So with that youngster, I spoke a little bit about what happens in that particular kind of trauma. But no, it's not something I normally do, but there are times when it can be helpful. And I think it's certainly very, very helpful that therapists understand these processes, these mind-brain processes that underpin the way a patient is feeling, being and behaving when they arrive in the consulting room and when they're working in the consulting room. The experience of danger permitted by or even at the hands of the primary caregiver brings into play all the most basic mechanisms we have in order to survive. As danger threatens, the brain's initial response is acted on in the brain stem, in the midbrain, and in the thalamus, which is an area which says, oh, what's happening out there? Milliseconds before it gets to the cortex, the thinking cap of the brain, where we can actually think about things. And that's why, you know, we're running. If there's something really frightening, we're running before we've thought about the fact we're frightened. We're geared up to do that. This response includes the release of hormones such as epinephrine, norepinephrine, that enable the hypothalamus to activate the most basic defense mechanisms to ensure the survival of the individual and the species. And those are basically flight or fight in the first place. And studies have shown that men are more likely to resort to fight and women are more likely to try to run. And that would be pretty evolutionarily sensible, really. Girls also go into the freeze response quite readily, and that brings its own attendant difficulties. And it's very, very difficult for a boy who finds he's gone into the freeze response when he's really frightened, because he then feels really bad because he's supposed to be the one who would fight anyway. So it can be even harder, I think. As the sympathetic nervous system comes into play, energy-promoting arousal occurs, bringing increases in blood sugar, heart, and breathing rate, as well as pupil dilation and increases in muscle tone and mental activity. But if frantic distress associated with trauma takes its toll, and fight or flight is perceived to be impossible, then our bodies go into a completely different state. Hopelessness and helplessness supervenes, overtakes us, and the limbic system, the emotional center, you might say, of the brain, it's quite a large, rather poorly defined area, but it commands the freeze reaction. It's the play dead reaction, evolutionarily speaking. You know, if I play dead, the predator just might go away, think I was dead meat, not very healthy to eat, and go. And the parasympathetic nervous system takes over. And even though we've got massive amounts of adrenaline circulating, the heartbeat slows, the breathing rate slows, the blood pressure lowers, muscles relax, and pupils, the eye constrict. It's exactly the opposite to what the adrenaline has made happen a few minutes previously. Very powerful response. And it's then Shaw suggests that disengagement and dissociation of both mind and body occur. And that kind of traumatic experience becomes encoded in implicit emotional body memory, if we want, feeling memory. It's not available to the conscious mind. Because, as we've said, the left hemisphere has received an electrical impulse which has knocked it out. In children under 3, the left hemisphere memory bank, which is the hippocampus, which deals with explicit memory, that's not up and running for under 3 or under 2.5. But for those of us who are over that age and have repeated trauma, as happens to children who are abused at home over a long period of time, people who encounter, you know, terrible experiences for whatever reason, then if it's sufficiently frightening, that whole left hemisphere cutoff response will occur. The hippocampus will be knocked out. The hippocampus tags time and place to memory. The person will not have clear, explicit, retrievable memory. They will have memory, but it'll be lodged. Some people sometimes describe it as lodged in the body, don't they? You know, they may have tummy aches, they may have headaches, they may complain, you know, structurally about their body. If feelings of anxiety, panic feelings, don't know why, all those sort of things. So it's lodged in implicit memory. It's lodged in feelings, sensations, body sensations, not in mind. So today, DSM-4, and I think even more so will DSM-5, define dissociation as a disruption in the usually integrated functions of consciousness, memory, identity, or perception of the environment. Chaffetz describes the fluctuating states of self-awareness that occur in the experience of the dissociative patient as alternating subjectivities that can exist without dissonance because of the particular effects of the dissociative defense. And that's where, in an extreme form, we get diagnoses of DID, or multiple personality disorder, the Sybils of this world. Now I'm going to turn to the unfolding of mind again. Jean Knox points out that mind and meaning emerge out of the developmental processes I've already described and the experience of interpersonal relationships rather than existing a priori. Panksepp, Shaw, many others, they all stress the relational, intersubjective nature of the development of the individual self. Siegel comments, relationships may not only be encoded in memory, but may also shape the very circuits that enable memory to be processed and self-regulation to be achieved. And patients who are traumatized are hypervigilant, very, very sensitive to threat. They're subject to flashbacks, which can be triggered by a stimulus that in some way matches their earlier past bad experience. And because the brain pattern matches to protect from a repetition of trauma, the patient becomes overwhelmed by an experience that has a here and now feel to it, rather than a there and then. And often in the consulting room, I think a lot of the work is distinguishing between something that feels here and now, but actually can be acknowledged as there and then. I can remember learning this so vividly from a patient who'd been actually very badly abused by her father from about 3 till about 9 years old, that sort of time of life, and didn't remember till very much later on, in fact until both parents were dead, and possibly was not able to until they were. But the therapist concerned said to her something like, let's try to get the words right, something like, you do know that he can't do that to you anymore, don't you? There was a long, long, long pause. And the patient said very thoughtfully and very slowly, well, he's dead. But she didn't really, really know inside her that that couldn't repeat. It was as if, because it was implicit, because it was held in the body, in the feelings, not in conscious reasoning, left hemisphere storage centers, it really needed emphasizing. No, you're safe. It can't actually happen to you again. There was a shut off, split off part of her that was waiting for the next happening. And that's really a very important understanding for therapists to have, I think. Patients find it difficult to overcome that kind of fear. And they cling to an analyst, you know, and cling is the word, trying to make the analyst all good, really containing. That can feel a bit uncomfortable for the therapist. But underneath, fear and rage are mingling, and often they can't be experienced as being part of the patient's own self, because the patient is furiously angry, actually, that such an awful thing should have happened. So if the patient can't know that they're angry, there's only one other person in the room, so they're going to decide that the therapist is the angry one, and that can lead to very difficult, uncomfortable feelings that people have to work through. So what I'm saying is, a therapist can suddenly be experienced as that bad parent. They're not. They're trying to do a decent job, but they're experienced as if they were a bad parent, a parent who's been actually quite sadistic. And in the case of the child I quoted, very sadistic. One patient I saw who'd been abused as a child, she brought dreams that really illustrated this. And they gave us a chance to work with the idealized and the persecutory. She dreamt, for instance, of a beautiful container with fresh, clear water bubbling up in it in a beautiful garden. And she, as she leant forward to take a drink, she could see a hand reaching up towards her under the water. So she stretched her hand into the water to meet the hand. And as she reached out to touch the fingers, what she thought was a nice hand under the water turned into a fierce piranha fish, which began to eat her fingers. She quickly took her hand out of the container, but four fingers were gone. So very scary dream about her analyst. Was it really fresh water and a kindly hand, or was it a piranha fish analyst? Same patient, two more dreams. She called one dream Red Riding Hood. She said, I went to visit my therapist, or was it my much-loved grandmother? And so often I find patients have survived because there was a much-loved grandmother. She said, I looked into her face only to find that it had become that of a bear or a wolf. I woke terrified. So is the analyst the grandmother or the wolf? Which? And again, the same patient. The analyst and I went into the theatre together. Just as we were happily finding our way to the seats, I gave a pretend growl. So this is the patient talking. She immediately changed into a hugely tall, narrow, ribbed, pink, fawny grey figure. I woke myself with my scream of fear. And there the patient saying, a pretend growl. And I should think the analyst felt a little bit hopeful at that point. A pretend growl. Maybe the anger's getting a little bit nearer the surface. And then the therapist has suddenly become the bad one. Can we have the next overhead? Thanks. In a recent presentation, Shaw stressed the hierarchical, vertical, cortico-subcortical functions of the right brain. He was saying that the connections through the right brain are very important. And that dissociation is to be understood not only in terms of the disconnection between left and right that I've just explained to you, that comes about because of fear and protection of the left hemisphere, but also loss of connectivity throughout the right hemisphere, because the top of the right hemisphere of our brains contains the emotional executive of the brain. It's the emotional boss of our system, the emotional thinker of our system, the emotional planner of our system. And Shaw says, maybe some of the problem is that there's a disconnection between the limbic centers, which is where our emergency responses that I've been describing to you, the fear, the fight, the flight, the freeze, that system, that's all contained in the limbic system, and really particularly mostly in something called the amygdala, a little almond-shaped organ right in the middle of our brain. And it takes all the warning messages. I think of it as the 999 emergency center, because it takes all the incoming calls and it has the response in order before we've even had time to think. So it's a very powerful little organ. It's also where all that implicit memory that I was talking about gets stored. That's where it's held, in the right hemisphere. And Shaw's saying, maybe some of the problems are not only right and left, but some of the problems are through the right hemisphere, those connections being damaged. Now, the therapist, this, and counselors, and people working with people, that really makes us have to stop and think. Because we've done an awful lot of work around interpretation. We've thought that words are what help patients. Words are left hemisphere. And I'm not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm not saying reject interpretation. I think, you know, our left hemisphere is what we think with, and it's a very precious facility. And it needs to be part of work. But it isn't the whole story. And for these patients, a left brain, abstinent, interpretational style of therapy won't actually be sufficient. Because what they need is right brain, resonant, empathic, relating. That's what that patient was exploring with those dreams. What kind of relationship is there between us? Is it a scary one? Is it an angry one? Is it a safe one? Is it a nurturing one? What is it? So there needs to be, I think of it as a double helix, really. There needs to be, on the one hand, right-brained, empathic, relational way of being. And on the other hand, of course, all that we've always known, the importance of words, the importance of understanding, the importance of being able to think about one's feelings about other people, and to think about the quality of the relationship that there is in the room. So it's like a lot of things in life, I think, it's not either or, it's both and. This is this book that I was talking about and saying we could put Jung's words into that book, and they really would look very familiar. They're very interesting, these writers, because they explore the way that we have, if there's been early trauma, of keeping a really good, effective defense system going on the one hand. Let that trauma never happen again. I'm going to make sure it won't. That's what I mean by a defense system. Not conscious, unconscious, very strongly unconscious, alongside another system which says, you know, well, come on, got to get on with ordinary life, got to manage. And the patients who come to my private consulting room are people who've managed, aren't they? They're people who've met probably all the developmental goals, and they've gone out and they've got a job and they've earned enough money to come and see a private therapist, baseline, you know. So these are people who've had a pretty good adaptive self. Winnicott called it a false self. And in one sense he had the right of it, because it is false to the deepest, in Jungian sense. It's false to the totality of the self, because part's been shut off. Part isn't allowed to be part of it. So it's false in that sense. But I also think we have to understand that it's an adaptive, coping, protective self. And Cal Shedd, who's another Jungian writer who I know a lot of people know in the States, because his book came out here, Don says, often in dreams you get a powerful protector-persecutor figure emerging. And that is, in a way, what that adaptive coping self does for the patient. It's protecting. Protecting long after the threat's gone, in a sense. Like the patient who sat in the consulting room and said, well, I know he's dead. But there was a part of her that was still protecting against that threat. It had been so, so overwhelming, so unbearable. The war was still there. And she might have been to his funeral, but she didn't know he was dead and couldn't hurt her anymore. They point out that the emotional side of the personality, this damaged, hurt side of the personality, they call it the emotional side of the personality, EP they call it, is stuck, actually, in the trauma. And I think that's what I've just described to you. And it persistently fails to become a narrative memory. As soon as we say narrative memory, we use the past tense. It was, if I said to you, what do you do on Sunday? What was the weather like? It was, straight away. It's narrative memory, past tense, it's gone, it's finished. The patient who's got this emotional stuckness is still in the present tense, in that part of themselves. So Bromberg, Philip Bromberg, American analyst, warns that unintegrated affect, this kind of emotion that gets stuck from psychic trauma, he says it threatens to disorganize the internal template on which one's experience of self-coherence, self-cohesiveness, and self-continuity depends. The unprocessed not-me experience held by a dissociated self-state as an effective memory without an autobiographical memory of its origin haunts the self. And so I'd say again, therapy that's trying to deal with the apparently normal personality as well as the emotional personality needs to have left brain and right brain. It needs to have words about, thinking about, ideas about, but feeling into in a relationship, experiencing. If we could move on to the next. And at this point, I just want to say a little bit more about memory, only very briefly, because I think I pretty much said it. Implicit memories, early, and it can be good, you know, a lot of our early memory is very good, happy experience. And hopefully for most people it's that way. It could be not so good. Explicit is what we have from a bit later on, and it's how we tag time and place to memory, and it's what those of us who are a bit older tend to find slightly more difficult to do when we can't remember where we've put our glasses or whatever. It's that that's a bit at risk. Now, this early stuff, because it's the very, very earliest stuff, implicit, feeling, being, behaving, it affects unconsciously all of those. So when somebody starts in therapy or in counseling, or at school at 5 years old, a child may come into a school class at 5 years old, and they look at the teacher with fear. And they almost look as though they might attack the teacher. They're so frightened. And a nice nursery teacher thinks, I don't know what that child's seeing. It doesn't feel as though that child's seeing me. And if that child had very bad early experience, indeed they won't be seeing, you know, the pleasant person, because internally they will have got an idea of people out there being scary. And so new situations like the first day at school, scary. And with luck, that teacher will spend a lot of hours every day with that child. And with luck, she might turn it around, because it might be just sufficient to teach the child it isn't always scary, it can be all right, and to build some other pathways in that child's mind-brain. That's why people like Shaw are so keen on ideas like Shaw Start, these early schemes addressing early distress. There's a lot of work the Anna Freud Clinic is doing it in London. I think Seattle is doing something in terms of early infant mother therapy. Is that what it is? Yes. Yeah, yeah. Pardon? Yes, yes. So that kind of stuff where people are saying, let's identify the babies that are at risk and the nursing couples that are at risk, and let's get the help in and the therapy in early on. And when the mother feels heard, her anxiety or her terror is going to lessen. The relationship with the baby will improve, and the mother will have more inside her to be able to give to the baby because she's feeling adequately supported. So the answer is get the therapy in as soon as possible. Get the help in as soon as possible. Could we have sheet five if I've... Am I anywhere near sheet five? I think I vaguely am. I interrupt my own paper constantly, and then I get into difficulties, as you can understand. Traumatic experience affects both the encoding and the recall of memory. Bruce Perry explains that as danger threatens, the brain's initial response is of how we feel. And I think you probably, if you thought back to a scary moment in your own life, different people will manage it different ways. Some people will begin to talk volubly, you know, because they'll manage it that way. And other people will think, I'm just going to pretend this isn't happening, you know? Different people will manage their fear different ways. One of the ways we may manage is by, you know, splitting it off and thinking, well, I'm not going to feel that for the moment, or I'm not going to deal with that for the moment, I'll come back to it, you know. Just get on with this and then I'll come back to that. All sorts of ways of splitting, trying to manage. But when we start doing that consistently over time with a lot of trauma, then we do put our minds a bit at risk of dissociation. Because if there's that kind of dissociating or splitting going on, there can't really be a proper memory of an event. It can't be processed by the hippocampus that tags time and place. It can't be recalled, therefore, in an ordinary way, because it has never been remembered in an ordinary way. All that will happen is it'll be stored in the amygdala, in the implicit memory, so that we've got something to match, thinking, if anything bad like that ever happens again, I'm gone, you know. I'm not hanging about to have that experience again. The brain has a system of pattern matching very roughly to trauma. And it's understandable, isn't it? It's evolutionary. You know, you don't hang about if the problem might be nasty. You're gone. We had the whole of the false memory debate, but we need to notice some of the actual stats that are around. Williams survey in 1994. In a substantial follow-up survey of women with documented histories of childhood sexual abuse, actually treated by that team of doctors in that hospital, they did a longitudinal follow-up study. 38% as young adults did not remember having been abused. If it's possible to wipe that kind of bad experience out of mind, people do. They found that the youngest, as we might expect, had poorest access to memory, so the earlier the abuse occurred, the less good the memory. Forgetting was most likely to take place if the abuser was a family member or someone known to the family. So closer is intolerable to think about. It gets dissociated. It can't be remembered ordinarily because it didn't get stored ordinarily. Dutch researchers note that the literal blocking of trauma-related experience by the apparently normal coping part of the self is the only possible way, really, for an abused child to manage her trauma experience of daddy in the night alongside her experience of sitting down at breakfast with the same person, having to get, you know, dinner money or whatever it is you have in the States to get to school, and a lift to school, you know. How else does a child deal with that? Only by splitting. It's the only possible way to manage it. The same applies to the refugee mother, who, having experienced appalling atrocities, blocks them out and seemingly interacts with her children in her new country from an entirely different part of herself. But the ghosts, or in Jung's words, splinter psyches remain. And they affect not only the person who suffered the trauma, but the children, the people around, her choice of partner. Because it's not integrated, it goes on having its effect. If the man who abused her had dark hair, all dark-haired men will be a threat if there isn't a proper processing and a capacity to think through. That's at its most simplistic. So what are the implications of all this then? The next one, please. Thank you. Well, first of all, I'm going to give you an illustration from work with a child, and then some visual illustrations from work with the children. You've done the hard part of the paper now. Miranda, who's a Jungian child analyst in London, saw a 13-year-old boy who both physically and psychologically presented as a much younger child. Jay painted a graphic picture of the defences occasioned by trauma when, for many sessions, he played and replayed a football game with toy wild animals. His analyst experienced dissociation in the form of mindless boredom. She said it was awful. She felt so guilty, but she just felt bored at the endless repetition. And if he'd chosen, you know, Miranda, if he'd chosen opera, theatre, whole gardening, a whole load of rafter things, but football, I cannot, I think, and we're talking English football, soccer. I can't imagine anything less likely to grip this therapist. It was as if he'd found the best way to switch her mind off that he possibly could. But his game would have switched her on if he hadn't chosen something that switched her off. So he was at this cusp of in mind, out of mind. And I'll tell you about his football game. On the wing, he said, was the cheetah. And he named him after an English player called Rush, because Rush could run as fast as the wind to get out of danger. Now, I understood that as flight. As forwards, that's the centre in the English soccer game, were a pig and a bull. And he named them after footballers notoriously associated with aggression. Gazza was one. Beckham wasn't, to be fair to him. But these were real tough guys. Fight. If all else failed, if the wings didn't keep the ball away, if the forwards didn't keep the ball away and get control of the play, then if all else failed, a large polar bear from the land of ice occupied the goal. Freeze. And he named him Peter Shilton, and Peter Shilton had sloping shoulders just like a polar bear. So it was, you know, very, very clever. And Miranda said afterwards, you know, if only I could have thought about it, it is so clever. But he'd wiped her mind out. And he'd done that very deliberately. He'd chosen something in mind, out of mind. Because he was saying, do I dare remember this? Do I dare think about this? No, I daren't. So let's have something that the therapist won't understand but might understand. You know? And that's not a conscious process. That's not left brain. That's emotional, empathic. Shall I risk it? Shan't I risk it? Is it too frightening to think about? It's a feeling process. Hope, but also the internal struggle, was carried by Jay, and he was a little boy kangaroo. And he could break every rule in the game. He could carry the ball, that's totally forbidden in English football, and he could run wherever he liked. And I understood this, really, as Jay saying, you know, well, I've managed, I've got on, I've coped, I've somehow managed. Miranda, that was the first bit she understood. She said she found herself thinking about this baby kangaroo who could take a free kick and score from the other end of the field, who could run faster than all the other players and didn't even need any other players to back him up. And she said, I found myself thinking that was an amazingly accurate picture of the defensive, do-it-yourself, heroic psychology of the deprived infant who hasn't got the emotional resources to acknowledge his dependency on the mother figure, but sustains himself with the omnipotent fantasy that he can overcome all the odds and supply his own needs. And that's what's so hard in this work with these patients, is allowing them to risk dependency, helping them to risk dependency, because it's terrifying. Because these are people who were let down in the earliest of relationships. They're the client group I wanted to talk about. We'll move on now to the clinical illustration. Could you put the first picture up, please? And it might be worth turning out the other lights just for these pictures. Try and get them to show. This patient we'll talk about her early stuff, but she arrived in the consulting room. All I knew about her was that she'd been working very well professionally, working with children, good job, married, two children, a boy of 12 and a girl of about 8, 9, and she'd suddenly stayed off work. And she wouldn't get up, she wouldn't feed the children, she wouldn't take any interest. Sudden major breakdown, depression. Not part of her history at all. And she was in her then early 30s. And she'd gone to see a counsellor and got very, very attached to him, a very idealised transference. And he couldn't cope. He didn't know what was happening. And he was scared, I think. And so he referred her on to me, and she came. And that meant she'd lost her idealized male counselor and ended up with me. And when you hear the story about Mum, you'll begin to know why it was quite difficult at the beginning of the work. She was an artist. She was trained as an artist. And I've told you the very beginning of the story. She'd got these two children. In her early 20s, her first child, a son, had been born stillborn. His funeral had been held without her knowledge while she was still in hospital. She felt she'd never been able to complete her grieving for him. She came to therapy because she was really frightened by her illness. But she started with a strong negative transference to me. I was a very uncomfortably close reminder of her denying and depriving mother. She was the third girl in a family where a son was longed for. Her history is one of early relational trauma with her mother, and then a seemingly and it's always seemed to be the case, isolated incident of childhood sexual abuse. I'm just going to drink for a moment. So the difficulty, part of the difficulty was they needed a son to inherit. It was English law, only a boy could inherit the land. So they needed a son. She was the third girl. Her mother wouldn't look at her. Her mother wouldn't name her. She went into hospital at 2 weeks old as a failure to thrive baby. Her mum didn't come with her, didn't see her. And when she ultimately came out of hospital, a nanny was appointed to look after her. Goes without saying she wasn't breastfed. When she was a child, her mother used to attack her, saying, "You were the worst, you were ill, and you should have been a boy. Everybody said the third one was bound to be a boy." She felt she could never please her mum because she wasn't interested in feminine things like her elder sister, nor very attractive like her younger sister. What she liked was to get out into the countryside and walk or paint. Her mother considered both a waste of time for a girl. And it's her paintings which have shown the story of her therapy, really. She painted this 6 weeks before she came into therapy. And when she brought it in, it's in much more vivid colours than the overhead projector permits showing. They're stronger colours. But it felt to me like a sarcophagus, like a tomb. And I was, you know. And we didn't say a great deal about it. She commented on having felt that there was a happy child inside her trying to get out. And I think that's all we said. I noted that there's a little fetus inside the happy child. It's a baby, very pale pink. And I wondered whether that was her early baby self or whether it was the firstborn son that she'd lost, stillborn a day before he was due. Or both, of course. Over the years, much later, we've come to talk about this picture and to look at it again. And she'll talk about her mother's hands being the outside layer. This layer here, going right round, is mother's hand slapping, pointing, punching, hitting. The next layer is a layer of wood, but it has eyes in it. And one of the things she said very early on, very often, was her mother's eyes boring into her as a child. And I used to feel that she could manage a certain amount of eye contact, but I had to be careful that I wasn't offering her too much eye contact. She said the next thing were like a skeleton on the outside. She needed her skeleton, not inside, but outside, to protect her from her mum, really. And her skin, which would be the next layer here, is red, inflamed. Too painful to be in touch. Not a nice experience of skin. Her hands are clenched, and she's androgynous. She isn't the boy that they wanted. She isn't able to be the girl. Dad, for the first 12 years of her life, brought her up as the son he so longed for. And she walked the land with him. She bred, she had her own flock of sheep. She traded wool on the English Stock Exchange at 11 years old. You know, Dad brought her up to be the son that she couldn't be, to be the one who would inherit that she couldn't inherit. And when she was 12 and his son was finally born after another two girls, he just dropped her. So she'd always cherished some sort of fantasy that she would be able to inherit, you know. And I think that's what kept her in this androgynous form in a way, because she couldn't go on to be fully a girl, because that would dash the hopes entirely. Could we have the next picture, please? If anybody wants to say anything about the pictures, I don't at all mind, you know, happy.
Margaret, what do you think of the wider side of our previous picture?
That, I don't know. I don't know. Did you have thoughts about it? She's never commented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And whether it is anything to do with left and right, mm-hmm. you know. And yes, yes, yeah.
It seems to fit with your theory of left brain, right brain.
It does, doesn't it? It does. She's completely sealed, isn't she? Yeah. Yeah. Inside. Nothing inside. Yeah. Blank. Yeah. Yeah. Because it was too scary to be, you know, with that mum. And everything she liked irritated her mum to bits. Everything her mum liked, she couldn't find it in herself to value, you know.
Yeah. What does that tombstone
thing
like when
you represent? With the hieroglyphics and that bit? Or the shape, the outline?
The thing that looks like that.
Yeah, the sarcophagus. I don't know. I think it just is the final. It's saying I'm entombed, you know.
Okay.
That my defences, my dissociative defences had to be so strong, they're like being in a coffin, you know. And there's such an understanding of what caused the dissociative defences. Mum interacting with her hands, mum interacting with her eyes, hurting interactions, causing, you know, a massive attempt to defend and to keep herself safe. At a huge price, because of course she can't reach out and touch anybody, can she? You know, there can't be any interaction, there can't be any emotional war, because she's in a coffin.
What do you make of the heavy blue border?
The heavy blue border is what we couldn't avoid. It's from the PowerPoint. It's changing the PowerPoint over. The blue borders, sorry, are nothing to do with the picture. These are originally PowerPoint slides, and you don't have a PowerPoint projector here. So I tried to put them onto OHTs, and they don't do so well, of course. This was not a woman who was sophisticated. There wasn't somebody who'd done a course in, you know, attachment theory or something. But she came painting this about 6 months later, and she said, my mum was like a steel cog lover, and she cut all the teeth off my little cog. And it's affected the fact I can't interact with anybody as I ought, because of the relationship with mum. Could you show the next one too? Thank you. Because these two are a pair. And she said, you know, the outer mum tore into her, and there she's portrayed in two ways, tearing into her hand, tearing into her palm. The destructive process. But she understood instinctively that the interpsychic made the intrapsychic. So she understood that those outer early relationships made the kind of sense of being mothered inside herself. Her internal mum was this steel cog mum. And I think in a way she almost was trying to protect her children against it. She'd been a very good mum, a very caring mum, but I don't think a very spontaneous mum. I think that was beyond her at this point. She's still very androgynous, isn't she, at this stage? Could we go on and look a couple of years later into the therapy? things have changed a lot. She isn't in a sarcophagus. She still is in a bubble. She talked about the things which had saved her, really. One was the art, and with it went an uncle and aunt who were her godparents as well, and they only had sons. So she was the much-loved goddaughter, and she used to go and spend holidays with them, and it was a place where she was really valued as a girl, you know, and a special girl, the only girl, you know. The complete reversal of home. And the uncle used to ask a lot about her art and encourage her, whereas her mother would call it her silly scribbling. And if she found them, if she left her paintings or her pictures, Mum just turned them up, throw them away straight away. The other thing she loved was the land. So this is gardening. This is walking the hills. This is supposed to be a hill path leading up to a mountain. But it's still quite a strange perception, isn't it? Because the labyrinth is where the heart should be. And she's walked almost every labyrinth in England. It's a symbol which means a huge amount to her, and you might like to think about that. Her heart's in her stomach, as we often feel if emotionally we're not managing. And the baby is still pretty central. We're getting to see how easily it was that the cord went round the neck, which is what happened to the baby.
It's like she's emerging.
Yes. Put the next picture on. These two came very quickly, probably about 3 months apart. She's female, quite a fierce female, but she's female, and she's emerging. And she's now standing on the labyrinth. She's grounded on the labyrinth. And the internal organs are where they are. They should be. They're internal, you know.
Could that bubble be her own self-protection now?
People have said, is it like an amniotic sac? Is she literally just getting born, really, you know? So, yes. Maybe.
Is the time span between the first part of this?
2.5 years. And we thought this was the last picture. And then about 4 or 5 years after, I was going to publish the book. And obviously, if I use patients' material, even for an occasion like this, I ask them, I put it in thick disguise, I read the clinical part to them, and if they feel it's okay, we run with it. If they don't, we put in any alterations they want. And in one case, I felt it really wasn't helpful to the person and I didn't publish it. But that's the process I go through. I say that because just at the time we were deciding that, yes, it was really all right for these pictures to go, and she was actually re-photographing them so that they were good quality for the publisher. She then found herself painting the last picture in the series. And she was playing with a Klimt picture, just playing. And she just found it was changing as she did it. And I would stress that this is all right-brained, empathic, relational, visual, you know. And yes, of course, the words that we've had, and there have been many words, painful words, awfully difficult feelings, remembering the one incident of abuse which occurred with one of the gardeners on the estate when she was about 8, 9 years old. All of that work has involved words and left brain and interpretation. But these changes, these evolving symbolizations, are the product of right hemisphere activity. Yes?
I wonder if she shows her female body. To me, it seems like that's what she owns and accepts her body. In here, she owns it, and she doesn't have to show it. Thank you.
Yes, yes.
Now, Buddha.
Yes, yes, yes. The symbols, the labyrinth, which I also noticed Klimt does use, but it's become, it wasn't on Klimt's cover, and it's come on her cover, and she doesn't have to be grand. It's, you know, a symbol. It isn't an obsession. On the edge are snowdrops, and she looked at the snowdrops in my garden the first year, really, the hardest year, the hardest winter, and they were a symbol of hope for her. And the other thing that's happened is a nice memory from childhood. There are daisy chains everywhere, and she remembered making daisy chains with her sisters in childhood. So there was something feminine and good from early childhood that was around for her as well. I think I've talked to you all enough. I think we'll stop there. Shall we put the lights on and turn this hot, noisy thing off? And, great, lovely. Thank you. Editor of the journal, along with Michael Horn. She wrote a book called Archetype Attachment and Analysis. And I think Jean would be the person to answer your question. We would both understand archetypes as not something inherited a priori, but as the scaffoldings which grow out of that early mother-baby relationship. So it's what's called an emergent view of archetype, just as it's an emergent view of mind, if that makes sense. So the archetypes are the earliest psychic scaffolding structures which emerge, and then we build on. They're what's lodged in implicit memory, one might say, are archetypal ways of feeling, being, and behaving. And Panksepp actually uses the word archetypal responses. He's a neuroscientist. The languages cross over. In a way, those of us who studied psychology in the 1970s would never have believed possible. In Britain in the 1970s, you know, emotion was a non-used word in a psychology department. It was all behavioural, you know. And people who mistakenly went up to university thinking they were going to learn about how the mind worked spent 3 years doing anything other than that. But now, of course, that would not be the case. It's shifted. Somebody else there, yes.
So, looking at a child who has some kind of early trauma, mm-hmm. and the neural pathways are compromised, and this person becomes an adult, mm-hmm. and has this split between left and right brain, enters therapy, and then the endeavor, of course, is to try and rebuild through mm-hmm. relationship, through mm-hmm. artistic expression, whatever it means, seems to work for that person, and of course over time it takes quite a bit of time. I guess I'm wondering, when the client intellectually understands this, as the example you gave where she understood that he was dead and couldn't hurt her, but something in her still believed that he mm-hmm. might be able mm-hmm. to, when there is that disconnect between what the mind knows mm-hmm. and what the body and mm-hmm. the soul knows, how do you, when working with that client, keep them hopeful? And
I think it's the quality of engagement of relating. And that's why I would put the relationship, and all the research does, doesn't it? It shows that the relationship that's made with the therapist is the key factor in change. It isn't which school of depth psychology or cognitive behavioral or EMDR or whatever, it's the quality of the relationship with the therapist, which is the key factor in change. Why is it the key factor in change? Because mind brains change in response to other mind brains. The brain is infinitely plastic. That's what the neuroscientists are emphasizing more and more and more, an understanding of the real lifelong plasticity of the brain. That means its capacity for change. It's extremely plastic in that first 3 years. It's very, very plastic again in adolescence. And that's why adolescents can learn like crazy suddenly, can't they? I've got a 15-year-old who I'm very close to. And just in the last 18 months, you know, I suddenly find, damn it, Luke understands the physics of that better than I do. You know, and he, excuse my swearing, his brain has just taken off, you know, in that sort of 13 and a half, 14 stage. It's like seeing something grow in the garden, you know, it's extraordinary. Very, very plastic. But of course it's why, you know, a kid of 12, 13, 14, they can get programmed, can't they, and become an extremely talented basketball player. But they can also equally easily get programmed to street drugs, cutting, anorexia, these habits learnt in adolescence when the brain is extremely plastic and extremely responsive to the curiosity, eagerness, seeking system, the dopamine system, which is the one that's implicated in a lot of drug taking. There's a question there and a question there. Yeah.
Well, as you were describing the game with a little boy playing soccer game, it reminded me a lot of all the video games that
yes.
Have like
any
young children that play.
Yes, and it does have that quality, doesn't it? I haven't thought about it.
Bouncing
yeah.
around and
Yes, and isolated often too, you know, I mean sometimes it's played in tandem but very often alone, isn't it, which I think is worrying, and we don't know the effects of that yet, we haven't had long enough to see.
Very repetitious,
very fast of course. I mean if you look at old movies, haven't our brains speeded up? If you look at old adverts on the television, the difference between the sophisticated slick 30 seconds now and the 2.5 minutes to make the same, you know, I wonder really quite what we are doing to our minds. And there are researchers who are saying no television before 3 years old, you know. I don't know the science of that well enough to understand, but there is very great concern about that kind of input too early. You wanted to say something, didn't you?
Do you have any researchers or people in mind who studied that, what you were just talking about, the teen brain, emotionality?
There's a whole chapter in my book called The Adolescent Mind-Brain, and if you looked up the references to that chapter, that would be the easiest way to find it. There are a whole crowd. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
I'm curious about war, Vietnam, post-traumatic stress.
Yes.
Are we ruining a whole generation by sending them to Iraq?
Well, I think we're certainly not helping, are we? Yeah. I mean, you know more about the people who are coming back from Iraq than we do yet, because, of course, the numbers are, you know, much greater.
But, if you look at war, some people say that not a majority of the soldiers have rifles, but they don't fire them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they freeze, and they just don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many people actually do it, and what kind of terrible things does it do to them, having done that?
Mm-hmm. We were at the art gallery this afternoon, the new art gallery, and we looked at a painting of an American with a gun at a man on the ground. Can you remember who it was by? Yeah. I found myself thinking of Abu Ghraib, and not particularly Americans, English soldiers as well as American, but, you know, and then thinking of some lads who, they'd all got injuries. They were hilarious, really. They were on the train. Three of them from the camp where they would normally have gone straight to Iraq, but they'd all got injuries. So they were off to Wales for a weekend's leave and a little longer on sick leave before they could go. And they were drinking steadily. But they were absolutely sweet with me and another elderly couple who they were just chatting to us if we were grandparents, I think, really. And these lads really, really, really believed they were going to do the right thing, for the right reasons, for queen and country, they believed it. And, you know, part of me intellectually wanted to engage with them and say, hang about a bit, what about X, Y, and Z? But I didn't, because I actually felt that I would traumatize them if I did, you know. And but they were in an extremely defended state of, I would say, an unreal state of mind, which they had clearly been prepared into in order for them to be able to go and do that. I don't know. It's not for me to comment on. I don't know enough about it. But if we stress ourselves, we know what it does to our minds. I think we can't imagine anything much more stressful than being in Iraq as a soldier. I think probably the only more stressful thing would be being in Iraq as a civilian or being in Iraq as a child, you know. Yes.
That there comes a place where the trauma in culture or the trauma in the collective psyche presents a barrier for that person or a limitation, that some things cannot be resolved in the individual because they're so prevalent in mm-hmm. the collective.
Yes, the things that immediately come to mind are some of my black friends who struggle, and some of my black Muslim friends in Britain at the moment who struggle because of what they're being identified with. And that's building massive defenses because it's putting them on the defensive so much. And I think it'll take us generations to work that out. Just as, you know, I watch the Lassells family, who I happen to know quite well. The Lassells, Lord Harwood, and the Harwood estates, the Lassells estates in the West Indies, are great slave traders. And if you go to the north of England, one of the places that you'll be told to go and see as a tourist is Harwood House. It's a very, very beautiful Georgian house, but it was built on the slave trade, you know. And of course, as I went to Charleston in South Carolina, I saw other beautiful houses built on the slave trade. But David Lassells was talking to David Harwood. David Harwood is a black actor. I don't know whether you've seen him in films here. And Lord Harwood was talking to David Harwood. And David Harwood's family were from the Harwood estate. That's why they had the same name. And it was for the, you know, centenary that we've just grieved, really, in Britain. And Lord Harwood was saying, well, the way forward is to try and make a difference now in the present. And that's what we want to do. He was saying, I can't feel guilt. I can acknowledge what the family's done, but I can't actually carry the guilt for them. All we can do is look as a family and look and see what we difference. And in fact, they do a lot for the local communities in Leeds, which are there are minority communities. But it was a very interesting exchange between them, and they both agreed that one needed to somehow get free of the collective in the way you're suggesting, in order to move on, not to be bound by it. But I think we have to acknowledge, in your sense, the cultural complex, the collective complex. There are all these layers. If you think about what's dissociated and what has to be dissociated. My mum and my grandma were closer to their ayahs than anybody else. They were both born in India, part of the British Raj. I grew up on stories about India, my grandma used to tell me. So I went back to India with, you know, longing to see the India that my grandma had told me about. Of course, that India's not there anymore. But also realizing that on the one hand, I had to go in a very invidious way and say, well, actually, my
stock were part of the British Raj. But on the other hand, I love India and recognize Indianness. And as you may have gathered, I go, you've seen it, you all know it, I can't disguise it. That's India. That's my mother's ayah and my grandmother's ayah. I sat on the wall in the Red Fort last Christmas, waiting for Joanne Culbert-Cain, actually, I think has been up here since we... She was doing a bit more sightseeing than I was doing. And I was sitting on the wall waiting, and I was watching these Indian women. They were going, I thought, that's the family. That's the bit that really drives some of my very posh English friends mad. Because it's so un-English. And I suddenly saw where it came from. So we can never... But do we want to escape that? No. But we want to find a way through it. What I'm not terribly sure of is whether I should have stopped a minute ago. Yeah.
We can go on all evening.
As I say, I need control.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.